Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Elizabeth Sammet about Anthony Swofford's painful new memoir.
Part of his way of measuring himself against his father was to join the Marines and, as he says at one point, to feel that that's the way to become a man, to prove himself.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' Joe Berger takes us back to the days when Theodore Roosevelt was New York City's police commissioner.
New York likes its vice neat. They don't like police corruption, but they wanted the availability of bars on Sunday.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Anthony Swofford first leapt into public consciousness with his celebrated memoir, Jarhead. He now has a new book. It's called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir. It's reviewed for us by one of our favorites, Elizabeth Sammet, the author of Soldier's Heart, and I'm delighted that she's here to talk about it. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Okay, so remind us who Swofford is and why we should care about him.
Swofford, who wrote his memoir, Jarhead, which came out in 2003, I believe, and then was made into a film. He was a Marine sniper, and it was an account of his experience and in some ways his betrayal of his expectations of what combat would be like.
In Iraq.
In the first Gulf War. And he never really encountered the enemy the way he expected to. And so in a sense, it was all of his training not quite fulfilled. He had hoped to be able to prove himself, but I think in a sense, and the film emphasized this in particular, had a sense in which he was never quite able to do that. And this book sort of picks up where that left off.
It's now almost 10 years later, and he's kind of got a new enemy in this one.
He does have a new enemy, and that enemy is his father and his own demons, really, I think. The success of Jarhead, financial success as well as recognition, was a mixed blessing. And much of this book recounts the spending of all of that money that he earned on essentially cars and booze and drugs.
There are a lot of women too, huh?
And a lot of women.
And so what's the story he's telling? Is he traveling? Where does he live and what does he do?
The story sort of begins when he has to give up his New York City apartment and sort of goes off into the woods to concentrate. There are suggestions that he feels suicidal at that point.
And how old, Elizabeth? How old is he, roughly? Is he in his 30s, 40s?
I think at this point he's probably in his late 30s or 40s. He goes to this place to retreat. The narrative itself is a bit disjointed. It goes back and forth in time. But it really keeps centering on the father and on the several trips he takes in an RV with his father, once to the south to visit his father's ancestors in their graves, once to a family reunion, and then the final road trip where he really confronts his father, which sort of ends in a parking lot in a snowstorm, and it's quite a disaster.
Was his father a soldier too?
His father was in the Air Force and served in Vietnam, made a career of the Air Force. Actually, in Jarhead, he talks a bit about what he imagined his father's response to Vietnam and to combat. But in this book, he focuses most on his growing up and on his really difficult relationship with his father.
And what made it so difficult?
In a sense, that's a bit unclear. There's a lot of animosity. There's a lot of venom. That's one of the words he uses frequently. There's a long chapter in the middle of the book where he talks about receiving a long handwritten letter from his father that sort of recounts all the injustices that the son had perpetrated. And then interspersed among the quotations is Swofford's own response to that and saying his father got it wrong and a kind of point-by-point refutation of things that obviously caused a lot of pain but in the telling feel a bit petty and trivial, the way all family squabbles seem, I think.
Well, as a parent, I can say all children's resentments seem petty and unfair.
Right.
Now, what about the mom? Is she a part of the story?
The
or
mom
not?
Drifts in and out. The mother and father divorced, and there are some references to the mother, especially later on when Anthony Swofford gets married and has a child, the mother comes to stay with them briefly, and he mentions sort of belatedly that he has resentment against her as well. But that relationship doesn't really feel very fleshed out, and so it's hard to know exactly. Part of what he says is that she failed to protect him from his father.
Okay, now, Elizabeth, you are a professor of literature at West Point, and you teach many young people, men and women, who are going off to be soldiers. You know officers. You're in touch with them. We don't want to generalize a whole lot, but here we're talking about a guy who did participate in the first Gulf War, and he's come back with some baggage. Does this fit into a pattern we know, or is this just Anthony Swofford, kind of a literary guy working through demons? Is the war, does combat have anything to do with these difficulties?
I think it's probably the latter. This is just Anthony Swofford and his demons. But I do think that the war figures, it is at once a sort of general story and a personal one, in that it textures the father and son relationship. So I think that it's part of his way of measuring himself against his father, was to join the Marines and, as he says at one point, to feel that that's the way to become a man, to prove himself. Subsequently, he says that it's actually fatherhood that does that. So in a sense, it's a kind of archetypal story.
Very classically American, no?
Yes. And so I think it partakes of those, but it never really feels fleshed out. It never really feels personal and detailed in the way that he clearly can write. Jarhead's evidence of that.
Is that a book you teach, or that your students know? Is Jarhead a book that still has some currency in the military world, or just the world of war and combat?
I think it does. I think it was an important memoir. I actually think the film, and that's just symptomatic of our culture today, but I think the film is probably more recognizable to them than the book.
Is there always the question with someone like Anthony Swofford, who, as you say, has obvious gifts, but has he not been able in some way to get beyond the first really important story he had to tell? Is this also about the struggles of a writer to find his vocation or to find the next thing to do?
I think that could be part of it. The epigraph to this book also talks about war rather than about family and fathers and those sorts of things. And so I think that the success of that book defined him as a writer, for good or ill, and that in some ways, he still returns to that. I don't know that he's fully sorted out how much it shaped him and how much he was shaped by other things.
Okay, you're really smart and you're a scholar, and we've got you here, so we're going to push on a little bit more. I'm going to ask you something that just popped into my head. We now have women in combat, and I assume you teach some of them and observe, participate in some ways in their training. Have we seen a major memoir analogous to Jarhead from an American woman warrior? Is that something we can look forward to? Could we see a different kind of memoir that comes from a gifted woman writer of real sensibility?
There have been some books. I am not intimately familiar with them, but I do think that the time has come when we will see some of those memoirs, and I do think they will be different, largely because they won't have that father-son dynamic in operation, and that Swofford's story is very much a male story. War is very much a male story historically, but that has changed. There may be a different way of a woman casting herself in this particular role as a combatant that will have a different context and a different shape, and that may open up new insights into this.
Because there's been excellent reporting, combat reporting by women, right? Going all the way back to Martha Gellhorn and more recent ones too, right?
Right, right. And so there have been women in those situations, but now, of course, with the Marines and the Army services contemplating opening up certain courses and certain branches to women, they will occupy roles that they have not before officially, although unofficially, of course, in this conflict they have been. There is no front line, and so they have been serving in various capacities where they come in contact with the same sort of violence.
And are you in touch with soldiers and officers now in Afghanistan or Iraq? Do you hear from them? Do you have dialogue, conversation still?
I do. I'm thinking of one woman in particular who's actually went through a particular training program and works actually with special operators as a as part of their unit. She has talked about the ways in which she was felt integrated into that unit and the ways in which the men actually didn't seem as resistant as everybody has sort of claimed they will, and that it's worked out really quite well. It's been a challenge, a physical and a psychological challenge, but one that she has responded to, and so she's in Afghanistan right now.
Thanks a lot, Elizabeth.
Good to be with you, Sam.
That's Elizabeth Sammet, who reviews Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir by Anthony Swofford in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, Julie, the annual book stats numbers are in, all sorts of figures about the book industry. First, tell us, who's responsible for this?
This is an annual survey that is commissioned by two of the biggest trade groups in the business, the Book Industry Study Group and the Association of American Publishers. And they come out with this survey every summer, and it gives us a little bit of a sense of what's happening in the industry.
So any interesting developments?
Well, one interesting piece of news in the survey this year is that in fiction, that is adult fiction, ebooks have surpassed hardcover and paperback to become the dominant format. So if you are reading an adult novel, you are probably reading it in ebook.
That sound you just heard was me falling out of my chair. In this rapid period, in so short a time, ebooks are now actually outselling, not just a big chunk of the market. They're actually the number one way people are reading books. More people are reading them on devices now than holding books in their hands.
Well, no, this I have to qualify this. We're talking about, we're talking about only fiction. We're talking about only adult fiction. So this doesn't include, you know, children's. This doesn't include YA. But it does say that of all the formats that you have now as a reader to read a book, ebook is the dominant format for adult fiction.
Wow. Now, do we know, Julie, whether that cuts across the whole spectrum? To give you an example, is Richard Ford, you know, with his major new novel, Canada, being read as much on ebook or more in ebook than in hardcover, as opposed to, say, the writer of romances whose readers, you know, may read novel after novel, day after day? Does it break down numbers, differences in that way, categories or not?
There are differences. We know that genre fiction, such as romance, mysteries, thrillers, the people who really love those books started reading them in ebook before people who read a lot of literary fiction, for example. So when you look at romance, it was really one of the first categories that started to migrate from print to digital. But publishers across the board are seeing a very typical sales pattern now, and that is that they will actually sell, you know, 50% print, 50% digital in fiction, which is really interesting. I mean, you have to think about, why is this happening in fiction? Well, from what publishers believe, it's because it's a very straightforward storytelling format. So if you are reading in ebook format, you don't have to flip back and forth a lot as you would in a reference book. You don't need any bells and whistles. You don't need pictures and graphics. It's just all about the story. And that's perhaps why ebook is the perfect format for fiction.
So, right, those last words of yours may be the most important, that it may be a better way to read fiction than in a hardcover book. You'll get everything you need. Now, there are people who are still, you know, write notes in the margins. I do when I'm, you know, really reading, you know, great work of fiction that seems to say a lot, or their insights and discoveries, and I write little page numbers down and all of that. And you can do some of that on a reader, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. But there are a lot of smaller reasons why fiction is really a very appealing category for ebooks. I mean, people who read a lot of fiction, for example, you know, what happens when you read a book that you really like? you love it, you want more by that author, you dip immediately into that author's backlist. And what's the fastest way to do that? Okay, maybe if you live across the street from a bookstore, you can walk across the street and get the author's entire backlist. But the faster way to do it is just to start, dip right into your Kindle or Nook and start downloading immediately.
Which is the reason they were created in the first place,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So, you know, a lot of publishers really believe that ebooks have made reading much more accessible, that people are reading a lot more than they would have reading in print.
Julie, this raises another question, though, which has to do with something you've been covering very closely for a while now. The economics, the finances of publishing. Now, ebooks cost a lot less. Makes me wonder, say, are paperbacks, what we call trade paperbacks, those kind of nice looking, slightly more expensive paperbacks, not so commonly found on racks and airports and such, are they now being threatened as a format by the ebook, because you don't have to wait for the paperback to come out for about the same amount of money you can get the ebook?
I think that print sales are certainly under pressure. And right now, I think the book business is in a stage where publishers don't really know which formats are going to emerge in the future, which formats are going to be strong in the long run. So you see publishers doing a lot of experimentation with moving up paperback publications. You know, it used to be hardcover came out, 1 year later the paperback came out. Now sometimes it's less than 6 months after the hardcover publication you will see the paperback in the store. So I think that the paperback is still going strong. That is the trade paperback, not the mass market paperback, which the sales were down again significantly last year. And the mass market paperback, of course, is the kind of small, fat paperback that you see in airports.
With the shiny covers. So those are the ones that are really most under threat. Those books are available as ebooks too. And I guess you don't really buy a mass market paperback to display in your private library. I mean, maybe you do, but that probably doesn't factor into your decision to buy it. So maybe if you're going to read a book of that kind, you're more likely to read it on the device.
And again, that mass market paperback is really popular in thrillers and mysteries and romance, the kind of genre fiction that were some of the first fiction to move over from print to digital.
Julie, is it too early to say, not that we want to turn this into a competition, but that there were, say, one or two publishers, book publishers, or even people in book publishing who were out first with this trend, who kind of got the idea that this was going to be a big way for books to go? Or as an industry, do they all kind of move in unison?
I think that when you look at the bigger publishers, they do seem to move in unison. I think that across the board for the last several years, for example, you know, publishers have been working really hard to digitize all of their backlist to try to make books available in any format. And you kind of hear that over and over again from the same publishers. That said, you know, there are a lot of experiments that they're trying. Their Hachette and other publishers have started digital-only imprints in romance and in other genres. So they're trying to see what works. And I think that publishers have become a lot more brave and a lot more bold in determining what they're going to try.
And there is big news out there, big good news, which is that people seem to be reading as much as ever, if not even more.
And there's a huge conversation about books in this country right now. You know, for all of the gloom and doom about ebooks, you know, there's certainly a lot of people talking about the book industry in a way that they weren't 10 years ago. I also have to point out, looking at this survey, that ebooks, even though publishers' net revenue from sales of ebooks more than doubled in 2011 up to just over $2 billion, ebooks still account for only 15% of publishers' revenue. So that's a lot of print books that are selling.
Right. It also seems somewhat analogous to what's going on in our own industry, where it's the digital version of publications like the New York Times that will attract the most eyeballs, as they say, but maybe not the most revenue.
Right. And one thing that a lot of publishers said, looking at this survey and its results, was, look, this is not the steep decline that the music industry saw when it was in its own transition years ago.
Because of file sharing and, oh, right.
Right. So there are a lot of people that are still sticking to print. You know, there is certainly a trend here away from print and toward digital, but I think it's perhaps not moving as quickly as it did in the music industry.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
In these troubled political times, sometimes it's interesting or a relief to look back at some older political history. There's an entertaining new book. It's called Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's Doomed Quest to Clean Up Sin-Loving New York. It's by Richard Zaks, and it's reviewed for us by one of the Times' great longstanding reporters, Joseph Berger, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Joe.
Nice to be here, Sam.
All right. So what's the story Zaks is telling? This is Theodore Roosevelt, police commissioner. Is that right?
This is Theodore Roosevelt as police commissioner, which, by the way, gave him a springboard to become a nationally known figure. This was in the late 1890s, mid to late 1890s. And Roosevelt was appointed police commissioner, and he became the Giuliani of his time. He went on a crusade to clean up all the vice, as to use Zaks's term, for which New York was notorious. According to this book, there was more vice back then than there is today.
Well, I mean, take us back a little bit in time, Joe. Does Zaks give us a picture of this kind of sin-loving New York City of the turn of the century, Gilded Age?
He claims there were 30,000 prostitutes in New York. That sounds like a much higher number than today.
Do we know how many there are now?
I don't know, but I doubt it's that high. Anyway, streetwalkers, and there were also gambling dens. There were opium dens. And essentially, the police, who were controlled by Tammany Hall, the jobs for police jobs were controlled by Tammany Hall, looked the other way, so that streetwalkers walked freely on right near the police, the Central Police Bureau, near police stations. And when Roosevelt went out to look for cops and see what they were doing about crime, he found them absent. He would walk several blocks, and he had a list of their beats, and he couldn't find any cops on where they were supposed to be. You know.
So this is Theodore Roosevelt, the young reformer. And why did he get this job? What had he done that qualified him to be the police commissioner?
He had been a state legislator, and he'd gotten to know some of the politicians. But he came from a well-to-do family, prominent family. And got this job. There had been commissions that, just like the Knapp Commission, that had investigated police corruption, and there was a feeling that something had to be done. And so they appointed Roosevelt because he was a moralistic and fierce-minded man to a fault. You know, one of the things the book makes very clear is that ultimately his campaign to eradicate vice failed, as the subtitle says.
Yeah.
It was doomed.
And why?
Well, it was doomed because New York likes its vice neat, as I said in the review. They don't like police corruption, but they wanted the availability of bars on Sunday. The law, one of the key dramas in the book has to do with Sunday no liquor laws.
There were not any in effect when Roosevelt
They were in effect even before Roosevelt took over, but they weren't being enforced. Mm. Roosevelt decided to enforce them. The problem was that there were all these German workers, German immigrant workers, and Irish immigrant workers for whom Sunday was not just a day of rest, but a day of drinking. There was a tradition that after church or after you went out and had a picnic and had a beer, or all this Roosevelt tried to block. He tried to enforce the law because it was the law. The problem that got him in trouble was that there was a lot of hypocrisy involved, because rich people could, under the law, drink. If you belonged to a private club, or if you could afford a hotel, then you could drink. But bars were not allowed to drink. So do you know? So what happened was, because this hypocrisy was so blatant,
and Roosevelt recognized
it. And Roosevelt recognized it, but he thought he was going to clean it up anyway, on his own terms. What happened was the bars simply declared themselves to be hotels. They did it by, if they had a second floor above them, they chopped it up into little cubicles, and suddenly those were hotels. Not only did this allow drinking in the bar below, but it allowed prostitution on the floor above.
So how long was T.R. serve as police commissioner?
2 years.
And what did he do afterward? I mean, did this it obviously didn't stall his career. He became president, became a national hero. But did it teach him anything about politics and governance?
The book doesn't really make that clear. What happened was everybody wanted Roosevelt to leave because Roosevelt's campaign was causing problems for other politicians, the mayor, the governor, Tammany Hall, and he was losing the Democrats' votes. Because many of the people he was traditions he was campaigning against were done by Democratic voters, like German immigrants and Irish immigrants.
And yet, it obviously didn't hamper his later career. What did Roosevelt do after he was?
Well, what they did was they had the federal government, and I think it was the Secretary of the Navy, appoint him the Deputy Secretary of the Navy. So he was pulled out of New York, and things pretty soon got back to where they were.
They kicked him upstairs.
They kicked him upstairs.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Okay.
That's Joseph Berger, who reviews Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's doomed quest to clean up sin-loving New York in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the various lists this week?
Well, on the fiction side, there are 6 new titles. Starting at number 1, Deborah Harkness, Shadow of Night. That continues her supernatural series set in Elizabethan England. At number 2, James Patterson and his co-writer Michael Ledwidge have a book called I, Michael Bennett. At number 4, Catherine Coulter's new FBI book, Backfire. At number 7, Susan Elizabeth Phillips has a book called The Great Escape. At number 9, Carlos Ruiz Zafón, I believe it's pronounced, has a short novel called The Prisoner of Heaven. And at number 10, Linda Fairstein's Night Watch is also new on the list.
And that's part of her crime series. This is Linda Fairstein, the former prosecutor.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Now, Greg, you mentioned that one of these books is small, but a lot of them are actually not so small.
Yeah, actually, 5 of the 6 new novels on the list this week are 400 pages or bigger. The Harkness that's new at number 1 is actually 600 pages or more. Russell Baker, the great New York Times columnist, once said, Americans like fat books and thin women.
And how about fat books by thin women? Now, what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side this week, the highest ranking new title is at number 3. That's Jack McCallum's Dream Team, about the 1992 U.S. men's Olympic basketball team.
Which really has become quite legendary.
Yeah, it was the first time that pros were allowed to play in the Olympics, and it pulled together I think Michael Jordan was on that team. And
Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, yeah. Charles Barkley, Patrick Ewing. It was quite amazing.
That's exactly right. So it's surprising, actually, that it's taken this long for a serious book to be written about them. And not surprising at all that it's gone right to number 3.
In this Olympic season.
That's right. Then down at number 9, Christopher Anderson's Mick Jagger biography, Mick, is new on the list. Anderson is a former journalist and biographer. He's done a Jack and Jackie Kennedy book and a Bill and Hillary Clinton book. He writes these kind of popular commercial biographies.
Any news in this Jagger biography?
Well, if sex, drugs, and rock and roll are news, then yes, those are all in there.
I'm ordering my copy now.
At number 13, we have Jose Baez and Peter Golenbach writing a book called Presumed Guilty. Baez was Casey Anthony's defense attorney, and it's a book about that trial. At number 14, the Mets pitcher R.A. Dickey has a book written with Wayne Coffey called Wherever I Wind Up, That's a biography. He's famous now for pitching the knuckleball, and this looks back over the course of his career.
Well, as they said about the Washington Senators, and I'm a Mets fan, I can say this, first in war, first in peace, 14th place on the bestseller list.
That's about where they are in the league right now, too. And then finally bringing up the rear of the nonfiction list at number 16, James Carville and Stan Greenberg have a new book called It's the Middle Class, Stupid, arguing again about the importance of the economy and especially the importance of the middle class in the coming campaign season.
So, Greg, this week you looked at the sometimes orphan list, the advice, how to, and miscellaneous bestseller list, and found some interesting trends. Diet books feature very well on those lists. Is that right?
Proving the other half of Russell Baker's Americans Like Fat books and Thin Women. These lists are dominated by self-help books, of course. And one of the things that sell very well are diet books. Celebrity diet books, TV diet books, and kind of odd diet books. At number 10 on the list, there's a book called The Ducan Diet, which is sort of a French take on the Atkins diet. It's a high-protein, low-carbs diet, saying vegetables and fruit are bad. You should phase that out.
Vegetables and fruits both are bad?
Because, you know, there's all those fat vegetarians out there.
Yeah.
And new on the list this week, there's a diet book called 6 Weeks to OMG, Get Skinnier Than All Your Friends, by a British personal trainer who calls himself Venice A. Fulton. He's actually also a British actor whose real name is Paul Canna. He played a Death Eater in one of the Harry Potter movies. It's sort of a crazy diet book.
Kind of a death-eating diet book.
Yeah. His three main points are skip breakfast, take cold baths, and drink black coffee.
And don't do anything else?
He also does advocate skipping snacks, and he's got some other points to it. He's also not a big fan of vegetables. He says that the carbs that you get from broccoli are worse than the carbs that you get from soda. So, you know, don't eat broccoli, drink a Pepsi.
Could there actually be some basis to that? I mean, does he substantiate this?
He cites scientific research for everything. As a personal trainer, he studied sports science in college. And in preparing this book, he combed through databases of medical journals, finding things that nominally support his claims. For instance, the cold bath claim. His argument is that your body wants to be at 98.6 degrees. To get it up there when you're in a cold bath, it needs to expend calories, expend energy to try to raise its temperature again. So therefore, you're burning off calories while you're in the bath, and it resets your metabolism. There's some scientific argument to support, yes, you're burning off calories in a cold bath, but certainly not enough of them to lose any significant weight.
And drinking a lot of black coffee, that's probably some kind of appetite suppressant. Is there any food that he actually likes to eat and encourages us to eat, or don't we know?
I don't know the answer to that.
I guess we'll have to read it and find out in between all those cups of black coffee.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.